There was a glow in the sky now, the false dawn that would be followed by the deeper darkness before the true dawn, the deep darkness that the Amadoda loved and used so well. They stirred quietly and grounded the shaft of assegai between their heels, ready for the order. Up, my children! It is the time of the spears. This time the order did not come, and the true dawn flushed the sky with blood. In its light the Amadoda looked at each other. One of the senior warriors, who had won Gundang's respect on 50 battlefields, spoke for all of them. He went to where Gundang sat alone to one side of the impi. Baba, your children are confused. Tell us why we wait. Old friend, are your spears so thirsty for the blood of women and babes that they cannot wait for richer fare? We can wait as long as you command it, Baba, but it is hard. Old friend, I am baiting for a leopard with a tender goat, Gundang told him, and let his chin sink back on the great muscles of his chest. The sun pushed up and gilded the treetops along the hills, and still Gundang did not move, and the silent ranks waited behind him in the grass. A young warrior whispered to another, Already the storm has begun. Everywhere else our brethren are busy. They will mock us when they hear how we sat on the hilltop. One of the older men hissed a rebuke at him, and the young warrior fell silent. But further down the ranks, another youngster shifted on his haunches, and his assegai tapped against that of his neighbour. Gundang did not raise his head. Then from the hilltop a wild franklin called, Quai! Quali! The sharp, penetrating cry was a characteristic sound of the felt. Only a sharp ear would have detected anything strange about this one. Gundang rose to his feet. Their leopard comes, he said quietly, and stalked up to the vantage point from which he could look down the full length of road that led to the town of Bulawayo. The sentry who had sounded the call of the wild pheasant pointed wordlessly with the hilt of his assegai. There was an open coach and a troop of horsemen upon the road. Gundang counted them. 11 riding hard, coming directly out towards the Kami Hills. The figure that led them was unmistakable, even at this distance. The height in the saddle, the alert set of head, the long stirrups. How? One bright eye! Gundang greeted him softly. I have waited many long moons for you. General Mungo St. John had been awakened in the middle of the night. In his nightshirt, he had listened to the hysterical outpourings of a coloured servant who had escaped from the trading store on the 10-mile drift. It was a wild tale of slaughter and burning, and the man's breath smelled of good Cape brandy. He's drunk, said Mungo St. John flatly. Take him away and give him a good thrashing. The first white man got into town 3 hours before dawn. He had been stabbed through the thigh, and his left arm was broken in two places by blows from a knobkerrie. He was clinging to his horse's neck with his good arm. "The Matabele are out!" he screamed. "They are burning the farms!" And he slid out of the saddle in a dead faint. By first light there were 50 wagons formed into a laager in the market square. Without oxen to draw them, they had been manhandled into position. All the town's women and children had been brought into the laager and put to work making bandages, reloading ammunition, and baking hard bread against a siege. The few able-bodied men that Dr. Jamieson had not taken with him into captivity in the Transvaal were swiftly formed into troops, and horses and rifles were found for those who lacked them. In the midst of the bustle and confusion, Mungo St. John had commandeered a fast open coach with a coloured driver, picked out the most likely and best-mounted troop of horsemen, and using his authority as acting administrator, given them the order. Follow me! Now he reined in on the crest of the hills above Kami Mission, at the point where the track was narrowest and the tall yellow grass and the forest hemmed it in like a wall on each side, and he shaded his single eye. Thank God, he whispered. The thatched roofs of the mission, that he expected to see billowing with smoke and flame, stood serenely in the quiet green valley beyond. The horses were sweating and blowing from the pull up the hills, and the coach had lagged 200 paces behind Mungo. As soon as it came up, without giving a moment's rest to the mules, Mungo shouted, "Troop forward!" and spurred away down the track, with his troopers clattering behind him. Robin St. John came out of the thatched rondavel that was her laboratory, and as soon as she recognised the man that led the column, she placed her hands upon her boyish hips and lifted her chin angrily. "What is the meaning of this intrusion, sir?" she demanded. "Madam, the Matabele tribe is in full rebellion. They are murdering women and children and burning the homesteads." Robin took a step backwards protectively, for Robert had come pale-faced from the clinic to hang on to her skirts. "I have come to take you and your children to safety." "The Matabele are my friends," said Robin. "I have nothing to fear from them. This is my home. I do not intend leaving it." "I do not have time to indulge your predilection for obstructive disputation, madam," he said grimly, and stood up in the stirrups. "Elizabeth!" he bellowed, and she came onto the veranda of the homestead. "The Matabele are in revolt. We are all in mortal danger. You have 2 minutes to gather what personal items your family may need." "Take no heed of him, Elizabeth," Robin shouted angrily. "We are staying here." Before she realised his intention, Mungo had pricked his horse with a spur, backing it up towards the laboratory doorway. Then he stooped from the saddle and caught Robin about the waist. He swung her up over the pommel of the saddle, with her backside in the air and her skirts around her hips. She kicked and yelled with outrage, but he walked his horse alongside the open coach and with a heave of his shoulder dumped her in another flurry of petticoats onto the back seat. "If you do not stay there, madam, I will not hesitate to have you bound. It will be most undignified." "I will never forgive you for this," she panted through white lips. But she could see he meant the threat seriously. "Robert," Mungo St. John ordered his son, "go to your mother immediately." The child scampered to the coach and climbed into it. "Elizabeth," Mungo St. John bellowed again. "Hurry, girl. All our lives depend on haste now." Elizabeth ran out onto the veranda with a bundle over her shoulder. "Good girl," Mungo St. John smiled at her. So pretty and brave and level-headed. She had always been one of his favourites. He jumped down to boost her into the coach and then vaulted back into the saddle. "Troop, walk. March, trot," he ordered. And they wheeled out of the yard. The coach was in the rear of the column, the 10 troopers in double ranks ahead of it, and 5 lengths out in front of them again rode Mungo St. John. Despite herself, Elizabeth was thrilled and deliciously fearful. It was all so different from the quiet, monotonous round of life at Carmi Mission. The armed men, the urgency and tension of each of them, the dark threat of the unknown surrounding them, the romance of the faithful husband riding through the valley of the shadow of death to save his beloved woman. How noble and dashing he looked at the head of the column, how easily he sat his horse, and when he turned to look back at the coach, how reckless was his smile. There was only one other man in all of the world to match him. If only it had been Ralph Ballantyne come to save her alone. The thought was sinful, and she put it away quickly, and to distract herself looked back down the hill. "Oh, Mama!" she cried, jumping up in the swaying coach, pointing wildly. "Look!" The mission was burning. The thatch of the church stood in a tall beacon of leaping flame. Smoke was curling out of the homestead, and as they stared in horror, they saw tiny dark human figures running down the pathway under the spathodia trees, carrying torches of dry grass. One of them stopped to hurl his torch onto the roof of the clinic. "My books," whispered Robin. "All my papers. My life's work."
"Don't look, Mama."
Elizabeth sank down beside her on the seat, and they clung to each other like lost children. The little column reached the crest of the pass. Without a pause, the wary horses plunged down the far side, and the Matabele came simultaneously from both sides of the track. They rose out of the grass in 2 black waves, and the humming roar of their war chant swelled like the sound of an avalanche gathering momentum down a steep mountainside. The troopers had been riding with their carbines cocked, the butts resting on their right thighs, but so swift was the rush of Matabele that only a single volley rippled down the column. It made no impression upon the black wave of humanity. And then, as the horses reared and whinnied with terror, the troopers were dragged from their saddles and stabbed through and through, 10 and 20 times. The warriors were mad with bloodlust. They swarmed over the bodies, snarling and howling, like the hounds tearing the carcass of the fox. A huge, sweat-shining warrior seized the coloured driver by the leg and plucked him off the driver's seat of the coach. And while he was still in the air, another warrior transfixed him on the broad silver blade of an assegai. Only Mungo St. John, 5 lengths ahead of the column, broke clear. He had taken a single assegai thrust through the side, and the blood streamed down one leg of his breeches, down his riding boot, and dripped from the heel. He still sat high in the saddle, and he looked back over his shoulder. He looked over the heads of the Matabele, straight into Robin's eyes. It was only for an instant, and then he had wheeled his horse, and he drove back into the mass of black warriors riding for the coach. He fired his service pistol into the face of a warrior who leapt to catch his horse's head. But from the other side another Matabele stabbed upwards, overhanded, deeply into his armpit. Mungo St. John grunted and spurred onwards. "I'm here!" he shouted to Robin. "Don't worry, my darling!" And a warrior stabbed him through the belly. He doubled over. His horse went down, sharp steel driven through its heart, and it seemed that it was all over. But miraculously Mungo St. John rose to his feet and stood foursquare with the pistol in his hand. His eye patch had been torn from his head, and the empty eye socket glared so demoniacally that for a moment the warriors fell back, and he stood in their midst with the terrible spear wounds in his chest and belly running red. Gandang stepped out of the press, and a silence fell upon them all. The two men stood face to face for a long second. Mungo tried to lift the pistol, but his strength failed him. And then Gandang drove the silver blade through the centre of Mungo St. John's chest, and it shot a handspan out of his back. Gandang stood over the body and placed one foot upon Mungo St. John's chest and pulled the blade free. It made a sucking sound like a boot in thick mud. It was the only sound, and after it was silence. The silence was even more terrible than the war chant and the screams of dying men. The dense press of black bodies hemmed in the coach and hid the corpses of the dead troopers. The Amadoda formed a ring around where Mungo St. John lay upon his back, his features still twisted into a grimace of rage and agony. His one eye glaring at the enemy he could no longer see. One at a time, the warriors lifted their heads and stared at the huddle of women and a child in the open body of the coach. The very air was charged with menace. Their eyes were glazed with the killing madness, and blood still splattered their arms and chests and speckled their faces like a macabre war paint. The ranks swayed like prairie grass, touched by a little breeze. In the rear, a single voice began to hum. But before it could spread, Robin St. John rose to her feet, and from the height of the coach looked down upon them. The hum died out into silence. Robin reached forward and picked up the reins. The Matabele watched her, and still not one of them moved. Robin flicked the reins, and the mules started forward at a walk. Gandang, son of Mzilikatsi, senior in Duna of the Matabele, stepped off the track, and behind him the ranks of his Amadoda opened. The mules passed slowly down the lane between them, stepping daintily over the mutilated corpses of the troopers. Robin stared straight ahead, holding the reins stiffly. Just once, as she drew level with where Mungo St. John lay, she glanced down at him, and then looked ahead again. Slowly the coach rolled on down the hill, and when Elizabeth looked back again, the road was deserted. They've gone, Mama, she whispered, and only then did she realize that Robin was shaking with silent sobs. Elizabeth put her arm around her shoulders, and for a moment Robin leaned against her. He was a terrible man. But, oh
God forgive me! I loved him so, she whispered.
And then she straightened up and urged the mules into a trot towards Bulawayo.